The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 12, right? Yes, episode 12, The Adventure of the Engineer's Thumb, or lack thereof. And joining me as co-host is Mary Alcaro. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Ed.
It is rather late for you, isn't it?
It is either very late or very early. It is 1 a.m. where I am.
Joining us from the continent, huh?
Yeah, I'm joining you from Krakow, Poland, where it has been snowing steadily and is a little winter wonderland over here.
Oh boy, I wish I was there for that. So
it's gorgeous, like living in a snow globe.
Oh boy, that's nice. Well, especially, you know, coming up and, you know, for the season that we're in.
For the season, yes. And I have my spirit of the season, because when in Rome or when in Krakow, this is, I'm going to screw up the pronunciation. My partner's going to hear me from the other room and be like, what are you doing? Żoławkowa Górska, which is just a fancy infused vodka. This one is lime and mint.
That sounds good.
Very nice. And the Airbnb I'm staying at is apparently a big fan because they have little special glassware that literally has the name of the spirit on it. So it's obviously I made a good choice.
Awesome. Well, you can drink that. I have a drink that you'll tell us about in a few minutes. And
yes,
and we'll do that as we talk about Engineer's Thumb, because that's what we do here on Sherlock Mondays. We deduce, decipher, dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in a kind of conversational annotation. If you are watching live right now, please like and subscribe and have fun in the live chat. And if you're watching the recording, I also invite you to please like and subscribe to these shows. That gives us greater visibility on the platform when you do that. Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast, and thank you to all of our podcast listeners. And I'd ask everyone to please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck. If you've already donated or joined as a member, thank you so much for that support. That's really how we get to do this show, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. So if you've not already donated or become a member, or if you have and you want to donate more, any amount helps. It really does. I invite you to do so, and I thank you. And before we start our discussion tonight, what am I drinking? Every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by tonight's co-host, Mary Alcaro. And Mary, what are we drinking tonight? Here's mine.
Tonight you are drinking the Achtung Manhattan, which of course means the warning, danger, Manhattan. Drafting off the sort of German theme of the story. This is 2 ounces of brandy. I have the Asbach Uralt as my recommended, although I've been told you cannot get this in Pennsylvania. So
that's
sorry.
All right. Other people can get it. It's a German.
Other people can get it. It's cool. It's very nice. It's very nice brandy. It's a little sweet. This is 1 ounce of sweet vermouth, a dash of bitters, and my favorite, the Luxardo cherries on the toothpick for garnish. For this drink, you are going to want to pre-chill your glass. You can do this in a coupe. You can do this in a cocktail glass. So you're going to put your...
There you go.
You did the coupe, which is gorgeous.
I like
it. It's lovely in a coupe. So with this, because it's brandy, I do not like to shake, as you will see in the... In the recipe, I remind you, put a few cubes of ice in a shaker or a glass, combine your 2 ounces of brandy with your sweet vermouth, and stir very gently. And at that point, you can strain into your chilled glass with your dash of bitters, and garnish with really as many Luxardo cherries as you would like. I always do an odd number, so it's 1 or 3. It's like the exclamation point rule for bartending, you know, punctuation. It's 1 or 3.
I did the regular maraschino nose this time, which I usually do in a Manhattan, like the bigger, you know, fruity candy kind of cherry instead of the denser Luxardo's for this drink.
Absolutely. For this drink, yes.
And I say that for everybody because no matter what a recipe says, feel free to do what you want with your drink. So.
Absolutely. Everyone on the New York Times cooking review certainly does. The comment section is choice. Yeah, these are always guidelines. And I usually point out in these recipes when I'm doing something for the theme, you know, when we're committed to the bit. So don't ever feel like you've got to rush out and buy something expensive. I always test that these drinks can be made with something that is mid-tier and accessible. So.
Yeah, and I love a Manhattan. I actually do my Manhattans. I just went with the brandy and the sweet. But I do a Manhattan with both vermouths. So
oh yeah,
eight, and then a little bit of the dry vermouth and bitters, and you know that's
nice.
But I love a Manhattan, and a brandy Manhattan is very good. It's different enough.
Yeah, and you can't talk about the Engineer's Thumb without brandy, because it is just everywhere in this story.
Well, everyone, you can find the recipe in the YouTube description for this episode, and I also send out the recipe via email every week for those who are registered for the show. It's one of the benefits of registering. I will send you this lovely little email that says, the show is coming up, this is the story, PDF, or I'll tell you where to get the download the PDF of the story with the original illustrations and the recipe for the drink. And you can register at the Sherlock Mondays homepage at rosenbach.org. So
I'm also, if
people may have noticed, because I smoke a different pipe for every show. And this one is an unusual pipe, so I thought I would point it out, which I don't usually do.
Very cool.
This is a cherry wood pipe. It's the block is cherry, and the stem is even cherry wood. And cherry wood pipes, frequently this happens. They make a stem out of cherry wood as well, whittled down a branch, so it's, you know, perfectly, you know, the shape of it. And it's a flat bottom, which is nice. So you can kind of, you know, when I've rested it down on the table, you just put it down and it stays upright. But it's a large pipe too. So, and it's got a big bowl and it's really tasty. Now Holmes smokes a cherry. That's one of the pipes that gets mentioned. Now, it doesn't get mentioned in this story. They're too busy drinking, you know, brandy and having breakfast. But he has a breakfast pipe. He just doesn't mention what it is in this, a pre-breakfast pipe. He doesn't mention
cherry. We don't know.
But the there is a story coming up later that he does smoke a cherry wood, and I have a different cherry wood pipe for that one. So there we go. But this
so
is
fancy.
The unusual pipe I'm smoking today. This story was published in March 1892. As I mentioned, there's a PDF of the facsimile of the Strand publications with the Sidney Paget illustrations. You can download on the Rosenbach's Sherlock Mondays page. And it's an unusual story.
Weird one.
For lots of reasons. And it's adventure number 9. And now, as we mentioned, they're all called, the titles themselves are always the adventure. So I love this. It's like, do you think you're getting an adventure story? It's at the top of the page, Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, adventure number 9, The Adventure of the Engineer's Thumb. So that kind of really pushing that what this kind of story is, an adventure. And there's something I have to mention about that. But Watson says, of all the problems which have been submitted to my friend Mr. Sherlock Holmes for solution during the years of our intimacy, there were only two which I was the means of introducing to his notice, that of Mr. Hatherley's thumb and that of Colonel Warburton's madness. So this one and then the Colonel Warburton is an unpublished case.
Yeah, and Watson tells us basically that is a better case to show my friend's many wonderful gifts and skills. But I'm going to tell you this one instead because it's weird.
And he even says it gave my friend Sherlock fewer openings for those deductive methods of reasoning. it's like the reader's being warned. Like, yeah. I know you've read the other 8 adventures and maybe the other 2 stories published, but you're not going to get that in this one.
Right. Like, this is something a little different.
Is he lowering the bar for the expectations of his reader?
Just like doing this to tick off Holmes, because I'm just thinking about, Holmes's response to A Study in Scarlet, where he's like, you've turned what, or to The Sign of Four, where he's like, you've turned what should have been like a case of clear deduction into a romance. And here Watson's like, I'm not even going to do that. I'm just going to tell you this weird thing that happened to us this one time.
Because what we'll get is basically someone telling a story to Watson and then Sherlock. And then Sherlock and Watson are just the frame around it. There's no investigation. Yeah. I mean, they wrap it up at the end. They go to the location, but there's no investigation.
There's a little deducing. But as you said, Ed, these are adventure stories. Again, I think we come to these stories. We've talked about this before on the show. We come to these stories as the beginning of the mystery genre. But that's not, of course, how they're being packaged, because the genre isn't really fully born yet. And so this is definitely more on the side of the adventure story than it is on the mystery,
yes,
as we would certainly think of it.
And the that adventure thing, it's funny. I'm like, hey, didn't I have this in my notes? I actually have it in my notes for the next episode about this kind of changing Doyle as an author. I mean, there's no mystery genre,
right,
genre yet, but there is an adventure genre, and,
yes,
and he's writing in that, but he's writing different kinds of stories for it, and he's constantly pushing the bar. He's constantly, yes. I mean, I said lowering the bar earlier, but what that was a joke, because what he's really doing is, I'm changing the idea that my readers may have for coming to a story like this.
And that, I think, adds to the excitement of what you get when you come to this story. It is something different.
Because it even almost, and it's still in the first paragraph, Watson says, when the facts slowly evolve before your own eyes and the mystery clears gradually away as each new discovery furnishes a step which leads on to the complete truth. That's what he usually does. Yeah. And that's that's a definition, I think, of a mystery story, right? Facts slowly evolve before your eyes, mystery clears gradually away as each new discovery furnishes a step which leads on to the complete truth. That's usually what happens. And that still happens here, but Sherlock's not the one, unraveling it.
Right. Much. Right. The circumstances kind of unravel. It's a team effort.
Yeah.
There's some assists in here.
And then he goes in, it was 2 years ago that this happened. And now he's finally bringing it to us. I keep going on about this sense of, history that Doyle's creating in every story. He keeps reminding us about there's all history to these characters that kind of deepens who they are for people. But it was summer of 89, not long after my marriage. And then this line, which really, he returned to civil practice. And he had
problems.
And then he said, he and his wife had occasionally even persuaded him, Sherlock, to forego his bohemian habits as far as to come and visit us.
I want to see this. Sherlock Holmes leaves Baker Street to come hang at the Watsons.
Hang out with the Watsons for a night,
I can't even imagine.
I have no idea what that is. It never happens. I mean,
no, we never see it.
He comes to Watson's house. Was it in Boscombe?
I'm thinking of in...
I think he comes there at one point.
Final Problem, he shows up at the...
Does he?
Spoilers. But, he shows up at Watson's practice, I think. Actually, I don't remember. No, it's his house. It's definitely his house in Final Problem. Folks will correct me in the chat, I know. But I don't know. That's what the chat is for. Trifles.
But this is unusual. That, I mean,
this is crazy to think of this. Yeah. I also love this line where he actually says here, right? I had returned to civil practice and had finally abandoned Holmes in his Baker Street rooms. And it said sort of casually, but I'm just thinking of this line a lot because this comes up, this will come up much, much, much later, said by Holmes in a case that he'll narrate in the Blanche Soldier in the case book. And I'm currently writing something on this, one of my favorite stories that I think not enough people read. But it's just funny to see this, the way this line comes through and how it's sort of flung like almost humorously by Watson here. Like, oh yes, I abandoned Holmes to his rooms. But of course he's visiting him. When Holmes will use it later, there really is more of a sense of abandonment to it, sadness to it. So it's just curious to see the way that line, that Doyle recycles that phrase.
And it's, again, it's another little reminder from Doyle that this is the textbook of friendship. This is, these stories are also their life together, how they interact all the time, how that happens over time as well and changes.
Yeah. And all relationships have their ebb and flow and their periods of closeness and their periods of distance and the good times and the less good times. But this is a nice one. This is a really, really genial Holmes and Watson relationship to the point that he's hanging out at the Watson's house. Yeah. But Watson's doing really well. So why not? Right. He's his practice is steadily increasing. He's not far from Paddington Station.
We find out where he lives. I don't think we know where he lives yet in a story. It's near Paddington Station. So close that the officials bring him patients sometimes. The train officials, someone gets sick at the train or on the station and they handpick the ones that they think Watson would you know help, and they bring him to him, and then that's what happens here. The official comes, and I think there's there's a joke here after you know the story because he says, "I've got him here," he whispered, jerking his thumb over his shoulder.
I underlined that this time.
So, he's all right. And
it's humor for you.
And Watson, what's he say? His manner suggested that it was some strange creature that he
had caged up in my room. Yeah.
That's an odd metaphor to use. But setting us up for like this is like really weird. Like this guy I'm bringing you.
Yeah, even though Watson is used to getting obviously railway cases, he's got that really great understated line, right, where he dresses hurriedly because I knew by experience that railway cases were seldom trivial.
Yeah, yikes. I think he fell off a train or got hit by a train. That's what he's, you know, some things that he might be expecting. And this is gruesome, but for another.
In a different way. Yeah.
And, He would stay, but he says, "I have my duties," and it's spelled Doties, just the same as you. That little, you know, bit of colloquial accent that we're getting there.
Working class jab, right? That the trusty trout.
Trusty toot, is it? Yeah, it's
T O U. Trusty toot. You're right.
Watson calls him.
Why did I make that a strap? Because it's 1 a.m.
I had to look it up, and toot is a slang for a watchman.
Makes sense.
And
makes
it is,
sense.
And it is just, even though it's T-O-U-T, it's still the T-O-O-T.
Yeah.
With the sound, it's a watchman.
It's clever.
Yeah. And then Hatherley comes in here. He's got his hand wrapped in a handkerchief, but he's very pale. And then... this dialogue from a man from what happened to him, right? "I am sorry to knock you up so early, doctor, but I had a very serious accident during the night. I came in by train this morning," and like he's still going on. Like
he's doing great.
you've lost a digit and
spent the night in the bushes. Yeah.
"I gave the maid a card, but I see that she has left it upon the side table."
Which how, by the way? Like
completely, you know, I mean, I think part of it is that, you know, British stiff upper lip kind of that I must, you know, that I must, I must remain calm. I must still remain polite and not break any, you know, rules of social decorum.
Like,
card is here. I announced myself. So,
I gave you my card somehow with my nine fingers.
And then he starts to fall apart.
Yes, he does. He splendidly falls apart. Fresh from a night journey, and he's like, oh, my night could not be called monotonous. And then does his, he laughed back very heartily with a high ringing note, leaning back in his chair and shaking his sides. All my medical instincts rose up against that laugh.
Stop it, I cried. Pull yourself together, man. Yeah, like, you know, I poured some water in for him, but I'm surprised he doesn't slap him. So
I know. It's like that Batman meme. Yeah.
Right. So, but a man, you can't do that. That's no, not you can't. What you do. But man, you get
not unbecoming.
He'll get him. He'll give him the brandy. he even calls it a hysterical outburst.
Hysterical outburst.
Then is he, you know, I've been making a fool of myself. He gasps, not at all. Drink this. And there you go. You know,
this was a rule. So when I taught, 9th and 10th grade girls, for about 3 years, as an English teacher, and I was always very cautious, like Watson, of this hysterical laughter, because I had remembered being a student, and I know that it's a very fine line between hysterical laughter and hysterical tears, and so I very much had that response because I have witnessed hysterical laughter before a midterm exam turn into hysterical sobs. And I just think of that when I read this line, because it's a very, very fine line trying to hold it together. But there is something really, truly eerie in that hysterical, out of control kind of laughter.
Mm-hmm. And he, but he gets control of himself.
Naturally. You know? Well, the brandy helps, you know.
Yes. Well, of course. It's the brandy cure. Brandy saves the day. And this is 19th century. It's literally a thing that doctors do. Like, it's really any alcohol, but brandy winds up being the common alcohol that so many of them use. Any story you read from then, but it was from real life. Doctors would give you a little shot of brandy, you know, to shock your system because you're drinking brandy, especially if you're not a drinker. It's medicine, baby. So yeah, all right with that.
I'm thinking too of like the smelling salts, but I think that was probably a little bit later.
No, that happens, but
that's for ladies though.
Yeah. Men don't get that. They just get brandy.
Get brandy.
So, pull yourself together and they get a little brandy. And then he's back to being, you know, Mr. Polite again. Doctor, perhaps you would kindly attend to my thumb, or rather to the place where my thumb used to be.
It's terrible. It's so funny.
So calm.
It's horrible.
And we get a gruesome reveal.
Yeah.
There were
it four. Gave Watson's hardened nerves a shudder to
me. I know. Come on. Like, which is it, Watson? Are you the old seasoned campaigner?
I know.
Are you, like, because we got this in the earlier stories, A Study in Scarlet and Sign of Four, where Watson's like, oh, I couldn't handle it. It was so, you know, and then he's always talking about how he's, because he was in a battle and should see this kind of stuff, but nope.
It's funny though, right? Because it's the grotesque that gets him, right? Yeah. He can handle, I get the impression that Watson's like, can handle violence and like good old fashioned, you know, men being shot on the battlefield. Yeah. But this is the grotesque and the uncanny and violence where it's not supposed to be. Like these are injuries you're not supposed to see where they show up. And I think that's part of the thrill of the disruption and the fear of the disruption of this is a very nice, handsome young engineer who's behaving like a gentleman, and he is missing a thumb. It is
a horrid red spongy surface. Spongy makes it really gross.
I know, it's really gross. It's really hacked out or torn right up by the roots.
So that's the I love that he does a gruesome reveal.
Yeah.
That doesn't usually, you know, happen in these stories. And then what caused it, you know, this has been done, said I examined the wound by a very heavy and sharp instrument. A thing like a cleaver, said he.
Deduction, Watson.
Yeah. And then no, that's he answers him. Hadley
said, yes.
Thing like a cleaver. And then what? A murderous attack? Very murderous indeed. You horrify me.
The dialogue is fantastic. I love it.
And
well, I mean, and the his response is fantastic, right? It's a question of hydraulics, you see, and it came within my own province. I suppose it is sort of a question of hydraulics.
It is, yeah.
Stopping the blood of your own hand. It's a curious way to think about it.
I didn't notice that line. That's true. That's a funny line.
Really funny to me. Like, so much of this is so, like, it's grotesque, it's horrible, but it is so funny. Like, there is something just ridiculous. I guess it's the hysterical laughter thing. I don't know. You kind of have to laugh at how gross and horrible this is.
I think Doyle realizes it. I think he's ratcheting up that. I mean, it's not quite camp. It's,
no.
But it is being aware of the kind of on the edge, this is almost ridiculous what's mm-hmm. going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If it and wasn't so serious, it would be ridiculous.
Right. Kind of thing, it would be hilarious if not so.
Which makes it that way anyway, for us especially.
We know how it turns out.
Especially in the post-Monty Python era, you know.
I was thinking of the pythons because this is a whole, you know, like, I'm sorry, I used to have a thumb here. It does feel very Python-esque.
Well, between your brandy and your bandage, I find I feel a new man. So I think it's just the brandy, really.
Yes, probably.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and Watson is like, well, it seems to upset you. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to talk about it. And he's like, oh, no, I want to talk about it. I don't think I'm going to be able to rest until I talk about it,
and
which is interesting.
It's an extraordinary case. So that's mm-hmm. that's the kind of things that, you know, will interest Sherlock. So Watson recommends you come to my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, before you go to the official police, because the official police, they're not going to help you.
No. You've already lost your thumb.
They don't help you in these stories, but Sherlock can help you.
He's like, I know a guy. And he does. and Holmes's reputation precedes him, right? Oh, I've heard of that fellow, answered my visitor. I should be very glad if he would take the matter up. Would you give me an introduction? I'll do you one better.
Yeah. I mean, Hatherley's really really follows the rules. He is very socially adept.
He's very sweet. Little engineer. Young engineer. He's just doing his best, you know?
Watson brings him right around. First he rushed upstairs, explained the matter shortly to my wife. That's nice. He still goes, like, he's working. He could go out, he could take a patient somewhere, do whatever, but he still fills in his wife. This is early in the marriage, right? So
honeymoon phase, as it were.
Watson's marriage, any clue you get to, like, what's going to happen in the marriage is, you know, and then you can never put them all together.
Nope. How many Mrs. Watsons are there? You don't
know. Well, this one, he lets her know he's going out, and they do. Yep. And then they find Sherlock Holmes was, as I expected, lounging about his sitting room in his dressing gown, reading the agony column of the Times and smoking his before breakfast pipe, which was composed of all the plugs and dottles left from his smokes of the day before, all carefully dried and collected on the corner of the mantelpiece.
Ed, is that what you do with your pipes in your home?
I do have a before breakfast pipe. I wake up every day and have coffee and a pipe. And that is what, and watch an episode of Doctor Who.
Breakfast of Champions.
That is my morning routine for a while now, working my way slowly through all the old Doctor Who's. So,
that's great.
Which are cool because they're all serials. So it's only a half hour little show. Watch that every morning. But I always have a before breakfast pipe. And I don't eat till much later. So it's not like I have a pipe and breakfast. I like eat like 10 or 11 or something, hours and hours later.
What a bohemian scene this is, though. This is so good, right? Like, yes. Watson's like, yeah, I totally expected that I would just find my friend just, you know, laid out on the couch.
Still lounging around in his dressing gown. I don't have a dressing gown, though. So I have to say that I literally am like in a full three piece, you know, or maybe my jacket's off, but I have vests and everything. I'm dressed.
Well, you know, Christmas is coming. You could get a dressing gown.
Yeah, I could. I would just throw it. I would still be fully dressed.
You'd still be fully dressed underneath. Yeah.
All right. the plugs and dottles.
Yeah.
I've heard this described as really gross and all. It's odd, but it's not really that terrible, to tell you the truth, as a pipe smoker. I'll frequently smoke. If I come in the morning and I only half smoked the pipe from the night before, I finish the pipe. And that is basically a leftover pipe. Does it taste as good as a fresh pipe? No, but it doesn't taste bad. It's fine. I smoke that. But the plugs and dottles are the end of any pipe that's left over. Like there's ash and then there's like a little bit of very moist tobacco at the bottom. And he's apparently scrapes it out and then leaves it on the mantle to dry and then puts them all together. That's weird. It's like, just fill another pipe, dude.
Clearly he can afford the rooms at Baker Street alone now. So
and I think this, I mean, it, I think Doyle is trying to say something odd. Like, this is an odd thing about this character.
Right.
But it also reminds me, like, maybe he's, like, it's a bit OCD kind of thing, you know? Like, I have to finish all the tobacco in all these pipes.
Mm.
Like, he can't leave something undone. And Holmes is, that's absolutely Holmes's character. He can't,
that's true.
Every little tiny detail, he'll finish a case and sign it before he finishes the case. And he has to finally catch John this morning. He's like, what about the rope? Is nobody there? Or did you bring it? And he's like he has to know every little detail. Nothing, everything has to, you know.
No loose ends. That's a really interesting take on that. I never thought of that. I had always just described that to like, oh, it's just Holmes being like weird and untidy. But no, that's a really good point.
Like, even smoking a pipe. Finished. So, you know, it has to be complete. This process has to be finished.
Wow.
If it's not, I have to go back to it before I can continue.
Move forward. Interesting. All right.
Well, he ordered a fresh rashers and eggs.
Nice.
And they have a hearty meal. And then, of course, he gives Hatherley a glass of brandy and water.
So medicinal.
It's the two brandy morning for Hatherley. I mean, he needs it.
Yeah, it's been a tough night.
For goodness sakes. So.
But I love that he just kind of, I mean, I love how they're just so sweet to him. It's really, really sweet, right? Like he lays him on he puts a little pillow out for him. He gives him his brandy and water. He puts it within his reach. It's like mom taking care of you when you're sick, homesick on the couch.
Yeah.
They're like, you tell us your story when you're ready. Like
you've lost a limb or something, you know, yeah. It's nice that people take care of you. So
it's nice.
The fingers count as limbs. I guess they don't. It's like
they're digits. I guess they don't. Yeah. Yeah. Unless you're a starfish, I think. No. But yeah, he's had a rough morning. Keep up your strength with a little stimulant.
Little stimulant. Yes. I could go for that. So he says, I think your breakfast has completed the cure. I think the brandy completed the cure.
It's the second brandy, really.
The second brandy. And then we get the Holmes listening posture as he's going to. We get the variations of this in almost every story when someone tells. So, and this one is, Holmes sat in his big armchair with the weary, heavy-lidded expression, which veiled his keen and eager nature. So Holmes has to get in some kind of posture. It's Doyle always takes the time to describe how Holmes listens to him.
Right. And he always looks like he's either not paying attention or falling asleep. Right. It always looks like he's bored or falling asleep, but we know that just means he's listening really, really intently. And that he'll stop you in the middle of your story to ask you a question that seems completely ridiculous or unrelated to anything, but that can be the most important detail on which the case hangs.
Yes.
You like my foreshadowing?
Yeah, there you go. Well, he's that we find out Hatherley is a hydraulic engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And
Oh, he's also an orphan and a bachelor.
Yes, I'm an orphan and a bachelor, which is a weird thing to say.
To lead with, yeah.
Yes. But it all, I mean, I get that he's saying, like, I don't have any family. Mm-hmm. It is odd for him to call himself an orphan. That's usually what you reserve for children, mm-hmm. not necessarily adults.
Yeah.
And he has opened up this new practice to make money. He worked for someone mm-hmm. else. Now he's got his own practice. Engineering consulting, and every day from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, I waited in my little den until at last my heart began to sink and I came to believe that I should never have any practice at all.
Who does that remind you of?
Yeah, this is Arthur Conan Doyle setting up his medical practice in South Sea, yeah. and nobody's coming in. So he writes Sherlock Holmes stories. He starts writing away every day and yeah. all the story. I mean, he's writing away because he has no patients coming to his practice. So
yeah, I love that. This is the first time I've noticed this, this set of lines, like just this sort of throwaway little set of lines in the story, of the self-portrait that gets inserted here. This is Doyle writing his reality as he's sitting there with no one coming to his practice.
Well, luckily, Colonel Lysander Stark didn't come to Doyle. When what a great name, huh?
Yeah,
and he's a colonel, totally. First of all, colonel, that military title, Lysander Stark.
Game of Thrones character.
Thin, completely thin, exceeding thinness, face sharpened away into nose and chin, and the skin of his cheeks was drawn quite tense over his outstanding bones. And he has something of a German accent.
Mm. I made a little note to myself here about his appearance, and this will come back up again later, I think, in the case, but just as a reminder, we're still dealing with Victorian phrenology. In this time period. Has that come up yet? Have we talked about this?
I think a little bit, maybe.
Okay. Well, this sort of pseudoscience that was
physiognomy.
Really, yeah. Physiognomy, yeah. That sort of pseudoscience that sort of gives way to the eugenics of the
yeah.
of the 20th century. But this idea that you could read a person's personality or character based on their physical features, and that some of this was embedded in the idea that the sort of criminal class would have these sort of leftover unevolved physical features on their face. But Lysander Stark seems to have gone in the other direction. This sort of exaggeration of, if you think about it, it's kind of like almost an exaggeration of the description we get of Holmes is gaunt, thin nature, but it's like too much
yeah.
in the other direction. So intelligence, but a sneaky kind, an untrustworthy sort.
And he knows, he already knows that Hatherley is an orphan and a bachelor mm-hmm. and residing alone in London. Mm-hmm. And he tells him absolute secrecy is quite essential. He even mm-hmm. checks the door to make sure nobody's listening before he yeah. tells him the story. He suddenly sprang up and darting like lightning across the room, he flung open the door. Passage outside, like he was going to catch.
Very weird.
You know.
Yeah.
Listening in, and he already is beginning to repulse Hatherley. A feeling of repulsion and of something akin to fear had begun to rise within me at the strange antics of this fleshless man. So
Skeletor. Yeah, he gets the creeps off this guy. This happens to have it several times where he sort of gets this, like, I have a bad feeling about this, and then he ignores it and presses on and lets himself sort of talk himself out of the situation he's found himself in.
And he's gonna give him money. Like this is a guy with an empty office, and while Stark doesn't say this is likely part of his investigation, that he knows about Hatherley, and he probably also knows nobody's coming to you, so
right.
I can easily get you to work for this money. And he mm-hmm. promises him 50 guineas, and for those who might not know, a guinea used to be a coin. It was originally worth £1. And like the 18th and the early night, and then in the early 19th century, the value was eventually set at 21 shillings. There's 20 shillings in a pound. So a guinea came to mean a little more than a pound. And even though they stopped minting guineas after 1816, people continued to use the term in a kind of colloquial, you know, thing, meaning just a little more than a pound. So 50 guineas is, you know, 52 pounds, 10 shillings. It's a lot of money. All you need to know. I mean, you could do like calculations. What's that worth? That's always crazy.
You started saying numbers and I started to glaze over in fear.
What he means is I'm paying you a lot of money. Well, we'll even find out that a little bit later, Hadley says it's 10 times
what I would charge.
So.
But yeah, comes to him with money and comes to him with, oh, your reputation precedes you, which I just think is interesting. This is one of the notes I made for myself in this case is this whole case is about like professional references and professional reputation. Mm. Because Watson says in the beginning, you know, this is one of only two cases that I've referred to Holmes. Even before that, he says, like, I used to be the person that they would, the guys who worked on the railroad would refer to me because of my reputation. Yeah. And then I would refer to Holmes. And then Holmes is like, hearing the story from Hatherley, and Hatherley's like, they came to me because they said my professional reputation.
Yes.
So I just think it's cool. This is early Victorian LinkedIn vouching for sort of people, and it's all about like the connections. It's all about your professional reputation and how far that goes.
Good. Alrighty. It's going to come up in the next story too, in Noble Bachelor. The same thing.
Oh yeah, it will. Yeah, that's true.
So he wants to take the place where he wants to take him to is in Iford in Berkshire. Mm-hmm. Iford is a made up town for Doyle. So if you look on your map, you're not going to find Iford. It's a little place near the borders of Oxfordshire, 7 miles of Reading. So it's up near Reading. That's the area that it is. And the house, he says, is a good 7 miles from the station.
And he wants him to take the late train, 11:15 at night.
Really? That's
And he's like, but I can't.
That's weird, right? I mean,
it's weird.
Guys coming in for a consultation and said, but you have to come at like midnight to my house.
Yeah.
And he's like, out into the country.
But I can't get back. Yes, you'll have to stay with us the night. You can hear like the crash of thunder in the background.
This is such a horror movie setup. That'll happen. And it's, you know, but Hatherley says, well, he thinks about it, he's like,
this is very awkward, he says, which I love for him because it is very awkward. Could I not come at a more convenient time? And the guy, of course, insists no.
Well, he says, I thought of the 50 guineas.
And Stark is not too polite about it either, right? Like, we've judged it best that you should come late. It is to recompense you for any inconvenience that we are paying you, a young and unknown man, a fee which would buy an opinion from the very heads of your profession. So this like backhanded, even though he's just said, right, that he's come to him because of his reputation, that he's like, well, you're basically unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And we see again Hatherley overriding his instinct that something here is weird and not good.
But it's 50 guineas.
It's 50 guineas. No? It's 50 guineas, and he's bored as hell.
I got to pay the rent. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And then he finally tells him a story that it's, you know, it's about they're mining Fuller's earth from a neighboring property, and they can't let them know that they're doing that. That's why it's secret, because he's trying to buy the property. And if they find out that it's there, and none of it seems to really.
No. And it's absolutely sketchy, right? That they're like, oh, we don't want the neighbors to find out that their land is also on it. So we're going to very quietly mine ours until we get enough money to buy the land from them without letting them know how valuable what they have is, this Fuller's Earth.
And not a word to a soul. And then he
leaves. Not a word to a soul.
And he leaves.
Yeah, so creepy.
Everything about it is
everything about it is not good and is creepy. And the story about the Fuller's Earth, he's not buying, and probably talk about the Fuller's Earth later. Yeah. As that comes up.
It's Fuller's Earth. It's a,
it's a weird kind of like, it's valuable in this period because you can use it in the cloth trade to kind of like absorb the oils, like the residue from like cloth making. But it's like almost volcanic, like earthy clay. Actually, now they use it in kitty litter. Fun fact. that's what's in your clay kitty litter, absorbing odor and other things. But it was rare to find it in England in this time. I think a lot of it was being found and mined in India, and eventually in the United States. So, I mean, it's a good cover story. It is valuable. Mm-hmm. It would be something you could make money off of. It's just that this entire story just something's not checking out here.
Yeah. Well, he takes the train, goes to meet him. They hurried him into a carriage and drew up the windows on either side. And now here comes Holmes, right? This question.
I have a question. What color was the horse?
Yeah. first, one horse? Yes, only one. Did you observe the color? Tired looking or fresh? Like, what?
the color kills me. Like, it sounds like he's trolling, right? He's like, what color was the horse? Do you remember? And have at least one of these like really nice clients that's like, I did actually observe it and I do remember, as opposed to some of Holmes's other clients. They're like, why the hell are you asking me this? Like, are you paying attention to me?
It's partly testing, I think, in the sense that, like, how observant were you? Because if you really remember the color of the horse and you're certain of it, I can trust your the other observations, your other things that you remembered. But also, it's like, I might want to identify it again. Like, when we go up there, we might want to be able to identify this is the horse. One horse. And the tired looking or fresh, I think, is the thing that really Holmes recognizes right away. Mm-hmm. Why did they hurry him into the carriage and draw up the windows on either side right away? So Holmes is already thinking we're going to...
In the middle of the night, right? Yeah. Like, it's dark. The windows are covered. It's all like and sort of like foggy.
Well, then they pull up the windows. And I was confused at first. I'm thinking like, oh, so that means you can see out. But then he tells us in a little bit, the windows were frosted glass. So that's what he meant. They draw up a window.
And frosted glass, I see.
So you can't see through. Otherwise, it just would have been open to the air.
It's like a little privacy screen, but that goes sort of both ways.
And so he can't. So he can't. But then they ride around for a while. He can't see where they're going. And
awkward carriage ride. He tries to make conversation. Stark is not interested in making conversation with him.
And they get to the house, and they hurry him in real fast.
Yeah.
Pitch dark, and then a woman appears with a lamp in her hand. It's very gothic. Getting all gothic, right?
It's super gothic. I was saying, were you getting like strong Dracula vibes? Like, poor Jonathan Stoker shows up in his handsome carriage. He's like, everybody in this town is being really weird about me leaving from the train station to go to this creepy old house.
Welcome to my house.
Pretty much. But yes, this the foreign woman with the lamp. Very gothic. I love it.
She spoke a few words in a foreign tongue. Mm-hmm. And when Lysander says something to her in a gruff monosyllable, she gave such a start that the lamp nearly fell from her hand. So, little oddness going in on here. Nothing's quite right yet. Nothing has been right. For this whole time, this is a perfect, this is the kind of case that Holmes is like, please somebody come in and tell me a weird story that happened.
I wish somebody would tell me a weird story. And it's like, this is perfectly weird. Red flags galore. And and our poor client knowing that there are red flags galore and just being like, yeah, but it's 50 guineas and it'll be fine. It'll probably be fine.
Yeah. Did it go into another room? He tells, well, yeah. I just wanted to mention what a harmonium is.
Yes, please do.
Dark puts the lamp on the top of a harmonium. It's just a kind of organ. That's all. You can really look it up and find out like exactly what kind of organ it is, but it's a kind of organ. So there's a musical instrument in this house. But this is the only, it seems, what we'll see in a bit, like this is the only seems to be lived in part of the house.
Yeah. And the books on the table are German.
German, yeah. German. He can't read German, but he recognizes they're in German and they're treatises on science, and the others are volumes of poetry.
Yeah, I thought this was weird. So I did a little wild speculation. Did you look this up too? Or
no, go. What do you mean?
This was on my whole like, well, what did, you know, here we have a foreigner in England.
Well, that, yeah.
Weird and suspicious. And yeah. It's like, okay, he's German. Tell me about why he's got, you know, scientific books and also poetry. We're really at the weird turnover point of like the old Germany, new Germany, like German unification. And so there's this sort of switch over in the perception of the Germans from being like dramatic, romantic, poetry, and being more scientifically minded or ruthless or cunning or crafty. And so this is kind of like cards on the table, so to speak, of these sort of meshing of these, stereotypes. Just to sort of flesh out the character, the stereotype, essentially, of how the Germans were seen by the Victorians. I mean,
and it's just a common stereotype then, and it may be true. Like, if you go through all the Europeans, who reads both poetry and science treaties? Oh, that's Germans. That must be them. Yes. And there's a kind of distrust of Germany that's been growing for a couple of decades in England at that time. And it's weird in England because the ruling house of England is Saxe-Coburg.
Yeah.
They're all German.
German.
Queen Victoria, Prince Albert, they're Germans. Their whole it wasn't until George V in 1917 or World War II that they changed the name of their royal house from Saxe-Coburg to the House of Windsor.
People realize
House of Windsor is the same house. It's just they changed the name from Saxe-Coburg to Windsor because 1917, we're fighting the Germans. We can't have a German name in our royal house. No one wants to associate with that enemy country. Even the ruling family, even 1890s here, Victoria's children are all marrying German aristocracy, and eventually Kaiser Wilhelm, and the German leader of World War II, he's her grandson. So they're all tied together, and that's what makes it weird.
It's so strange.
The general public is starting to really distrust Germany. You know, Bismarck is starting this, you know, kind of industrialization and militarization of Germany that's happening.
Yep.
Germany wants to be an empire like England is an empire, like France was an empire, you know.
There are rumblings.
And people are starting to really distrust them. And so it's not surprising that if Doyle wants a go-to character that you're not going to trust right off the bat, that he's going to make him German at this time.
Right, and a cunning character, right? Because we get our sort of like savages, heavy scare quotes of people who have spent time in the colonies, who have sort of been corrupted by the wildness of living in places like India or in Africa. But this is an intellectual kind of opponent. This is a different kind of creepy, distrustful untrustworthy kind of character.
Adderley says, everything was deadly still. A vague feeling of uneasiness began to steal over me just now. Who were these German people, and what were they doing living in this strange, out of the way place? And where was this place? Like, he knows nothing. He's just been thrown out in the middle of the place of some place that he thinks he's just stranded. He doesn't know where he is. But it's the who were these German people, and what were they doing? That sounds like a political statement right there for the times.
It really is.
Stark leaves him alone, and then the woman comes in, the lamp beating upon her eager and beautiful face, but she looks sick with fear, and she's like, leave. I would go.
I would go.
I stay here. Like, this is, and this, again, we're in a horror movie, right? So
a beautiful woman with a lamp tells you, you should leave.
Get out.
Terrifying. Of course she's beautiful, right? Because she's his ally. She's good. The goodness on the inside is reflected on the outside, right? But he's like, but I came to do a job. And she's like, you should still get out of here. Like, it's not worth your while to wait. Like,
for the love of heaven, she says, get away from here before it is too late.
Right.
So she's even evoking, you know, religious sentiment in that, you know, you should leave here.
But he is 25 and his brain is not done cooking yet. I am somewhat headstrong by nature and the more ready to engage in an affair where there is some obstacle in the way.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks about the 50 guineas and now he's like, well, now I want to know what's up.
Well, and she might be crazy. This woman might, for all I know, be a monomaniac. Like,
yeah, obviously. Yeah. It's not the creepy man who's been giving you the creeps for the entire time, who like basically abducted you in this carriage and brought you to the middle of God knows where. This woman who's only trying to help you is possibly a monomaniac.
Yes.
It's fine. It's fine. He'll figure it out. Well,
before we move on and get to what happens next, I want to take this moment to thank you all for watching or listening to Sherlock Mondays. The Rosenbach's community reaches all around the globe, brought together by our love for history, rare books, manuscripts, and the arts. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do at our website, or by becoming a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, and exclusive invitations to members-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website, and part of membership is early access to program and course registration. And we're just starting to release our winter programs and courses. Just to give you a taste, some of the courses coming up, there is going to be a online Dracula course that I am teaching for the Rosenbach, which will also include if you live in the Philadelphia area, I'll have an in-person presentation of the Dracula materials we have, Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, the early editions. If you don't live in the area, I will do that presentation for you online, and then the class will meet online. There's going to be a Ulysses course. It is a weekly Ulysses course, 18 weeks, 18 chapters of Ulysses, starting in February and leading up to just before Bloomsday. Immersive. It'll be a lot of fun, and it's a great way to take a Ulysses course. We'll have a Robert Burns course. We have a Virginia Woolf course. There's lots of great in-person programs as well, including our great Burns Night celebrations, a celebration on January 25th. Members will be able to register on December 14th. So December 14th, 2023, if this is far in the future when you're watching this episode, I'm talking about December 14th, 2023. That's when members can register for programs and courses. The general public can register on January 3rd. So it's coming up very soon. If you joined us, you'll get emails from the Rosenbach telling you that the things are posted and they're ready for registration. But members get to first crack at it, which is a really, great benefit for members. But I really can't stress how important it is if you haven't made a donation or joined as a member or have the ability to make a further donation. I would be so grateful if you do so. There is also an episode of a podcast called I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere that I was just on talking about the, Sherlock Holmes, this show and the other BiblioVenture shows that we've done. And I put the link in the live chat for you to look that up. It's episode 277 of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. The hosts of that show, who've been doing that show, it's a Sherlock Holmes podcast. They've been doing it for 17 years. Scott Monty and Bert Wolder will join us on Sherlock Mondays on episode 14, which will be live on December 18th, to talk about Sherlockian podcasting, which they certainly know about. So Scott Monty and Bert Walder will join us as special guests in a couple episodes. And I want to let everyone know, some of you, I also do another biblioventure called Pickwick Monthly, in which we are going through all of Charles Dickens's The Pickwick Papers as it was released, serial, 2-3 chapters a month, one part a month. And we started in March earlier this year. We're going to finish next year in October. It's 20 months. And this month is the special Christmas number, because Dickens and Pickwick Papers kept his characters in tune with the seasons of the year, the time of the year. So the Christmas number, which is number 10, will be live on Saturday, December 16th. It's a good one just to jump in and watch, even if you haven't read the beginning, you know, the first nine, you know, parts of the book, in that it is it's them celebrating Christmas. And there's a Christmas story, the story of the goblins who stole a sexton, which is like a prototype of A Christmas Carol. It's the same kind of story, the same kind of thing happens. And it's really interesting to see what Dickens did with that. And it's a lot of fun. And I welcome people from Sherlock Mondays to join us on Pickwick Monthly. And if you can't watch live on the Saturday afternoon that it airs at 2 p.m. Eastern on December 18th, the episode's there for you to watch afterwards. So watch it on Christmas Eve. That'd be a good Christmas show to do. Alrighty, thank you. Back to the story. The Lysander Stark comes back in with a short, thick man with a chinchilla beard growing out of the creases of his double chin. This is Mr. Ferguson. Yeah, that's really gross sounding.
Yeah. Mr. Ferguson is an early neck beard sporter. It's gross.
And it's a chinchilla beard. Which seems to just mean short and fuzzy, like it would be like fuzzy on a chinchilla or any kind of really animal like that, short and fuzzy. But it's in like the creases of his double chin. That sounds really I guess
unsavory.
It's a hard shave, right? When you get all the chins. But yes, it's weird, and it's also a little weird. It makes him unusual. So.
Unsettling, more unsettling things. So even though he's not going to listen to this lovely lady that's trying to get him to escape, he will cover for her, right? Mm-hmm. By the way, I was under the impression that I left this door shut just now. I fear that you have felt the draught. On the contrary, I said, I opened the door myself because I felt the room to be a little close. So he won't listen to her, but he does know, he does have enough sense that something's not right here. He has seen the way she reacts when Stark speaks to her. He's going to cover for her here.
She is a beautiful woman, and he needs to protect her, because that's what men do.
Yes, it's his very noble instinct. He's good for him. She's even if she may be a monomaniac, we don't know.
In his time, that's what they. I mean, it's his. That's the chivalrous thing. It's what Watson would do.
It is what Watson would do. That's absolutely true. It's very Watson-like behavior. And Stark's not buying it, right? He shot one of his suspicious looks at me. Perhaps we had better proceed with the business then. He's going up to see the machine.
And they go through the house, and it is... It's funny, when I first put out a description for the show, and then they go into the basement of the house, and like... In my imagination, but actually it's not. This is like
it's weird. Yeah. Weird. And he's like, you're milling, like you're digging Fuller's earth, which you pull out of a pit in your house. And he's like, no, we're just compressing the bricks, but like, don't worry about it. It's like, but I'm here to worry about it.
And they go upstairs, and it's a labyrinth of an old house with corridors, passages, narrow winding staircases, little low doors, the thresholds of which were hollowed out by the generations who had crossed them. No carpets, no signs of any furniture above the ground floor. The plaster was peeling off the walls. The damp was breaking through in green, unhealthy blotches. I mean, this is and now, you know, Jason's going to come out and murder you. So, you know, it's clearly going to happen. Jigsaw's in this house.
It's bad.
This is where you go to die.
Yeah, and he's trying to be unconcerned about it, but he had not forgotten the warnings of the lady, even though I disregarded them. He's looking at these two guys.
Now, I think of this as the, like, for me, these are all horror movie tropes that are going mm-hmm. on. But for his audience, there's still gothic, you know, yes. you know, kind of mystery tropes that are happening, that it's all the things that you need to be aware that there's something dangerous or something bad is going to happen to you in this place mm-hmm. that Doyle is presenting here.
Definitely. They don't have a Friday the 13th yet, but they do have gothic tropes. They do have Anne Radcliffe. They know that it's bad. If the damp is breaking in on your creepy house full of foreigners in the middle of the night, they are getting the signposting that this is bad news.
And we just finished a gothic story. We just finished Speckled Band, and then
oh yes, we did.
Like, Doyle loves the gothic. You know,
it's great.
He loves using the gothic in his stories here, and he writes. There's a whole collection of Oxford University Press put out a whole collection of gothic stories by Conan Doyle, he's got lots of stories like that. Matter of fact, the BBC, Mark Gatiss has resurrected a tradition and does a ghost story for Christmas movie on that airs on the BBC on Christmas every year. And it's usually an M.R. James story, the greatest mm-hmm. ghost story writer in at least English for me. And this year, though, he's doing a Doyle story called mm-hmm. Lot 249, mm-hmm. and which is a great story. And it's a mummy story. Mm-hmm. So it's really good. But it's what Doyle wrote a lot of these, you know, gothic, what we would call horror stories now. Mm-hmm. So they're all, so he's well schooled in this already at this stage, knowing how to write these kind of tales.
Yeah, it's very cool to see Doyle try to incorporate his different sort of generic interests into the Sherlock Holmes stories. He'll do a little more almost noir kind of stuff by the time we get to the 20s when he's writing these stories. But it is fun to see him try to play with certain elements and pull them in.
We'll get some I think Poe in this again.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah, we're in the machine.
Yeah, he takes him to the press, and the colonel says, "We are now actually within the hydraulic press, and it would be a particularly unpleasant thing for us if anyone were to turn it on." And that, you know, foreboding. That's, and then he's. So he goes in to figure out, to look in the machine, and then he sees that he sees there's a crust of metallic deposit on the floor, and he realizes he hasn't believed the Fuller's Earth story to begin with, and he's like, what's going on here? And then Stark realizes that he's, you know, maybe discovered what they're doing. You shall know all about the machine, and he slams the door. And then now he's trapped inside the chamber.
Trapped inside the machine.
With the ceiling starting to lower. And this is right out of the Pit and the Pendulum. This happens in the
Pit. It is, yeah. It's terrifying. And he has that horrible line where he's like, it flashed through my mind that the pain of my death would depend very much on the position in which I met it. And he walks us through how horrible it would be to be sort of squished.
There's two things that happen in the Pit and the Pendulum. It's someone trapped in a room, and first all the walls and ceiling are closing in, and then that stops, and then it's the pendulum with the blade, you know. And it's this slow kind of, you know, and now Doyle doesn't write like four pages of him waiting to die, which is what Poe did. But here it's you still get it in little bits. The black ceiling was coming down upon me. slowly, jerkily, but as none knew better than myself, with a force which must within a minute grind me to a shapeless pulp. And then he thinks of how, what's the least painful way to be crushed and depressed? Like,
I should, he is an engineer after all.
Yes. I should, you know, it should come onto my spine. That would be, you know, but the snap, the dreadful snap. And then he's finally able to escape. He realizes because it's in this upstairs of a house, the walls are wood. Sees a slat. He's able to push the wall out on the other side. And and as he does, the lamp that he had in there, the oil lamp, gets crushed.
He's waiting on the other side.
Is the woman with her, with, you know, she pulls him up, says, come, she cried breathlessly. They're after you.
Finally, this time at least. I did not score.
Now he believes her, right?
Yeah. Now that he's almost been crushed, the good friend whose warning I had so foolishly rejected spirits him through, tries to get him through the bedroom. The moon is shining. It's great. It is very gothic. It's lovely. And as this happens, who comes rushing into the room? Colonel Stark with the cleaver in his hand. Like, this is like horror movie slasher film, isn't it?
A weapon like a butcher's cleaver.
Oof.
And he goes to the window and it's 30 feet down and she tells him jump. Like, it's
right. It's so up, get but out.
You got to get out.
But he can't because
she's there holding him back, holding Stark back. Fritz, she cried in English. Remember your promise after the last time. You said it should not be again. He will be silent. Oh, he will be silent. This is exactly a horror movie. Like, I think
horrifying.
You are mad, Elise. And then, you know, he goes after him. And then it is, I'll read this. And then I'm going to share the Paget picture, the Sidney Paget illustration. I had let myself go and was hanging with my fingers in the window slot and my hands across the sill when his blow fell. I was conscious of a dull pain. My grip loosened and I fell into the garden below. So we don't get a gruesome kind of payoff here. But the image is, well, it's not gruesome. It's certainly quite evocative of what's going on here. And here it is. So here he is with his...
Yikes.
His giant cleaver over him, and he's hanging on. And it's interesting because the way you would hang on to a sill, you'd have to think, how is he going to cut the thumb off?
Yeah.
But Paget has made sure that he has the thumb pointed out here. So it makes sense that when, like, you think he would cut his hand, he would cut into it, cut another finger off, but not your thumb. You're not using your thumb to hang on. But Paget has made it so the thumb is still over the sill. So it makes sense to get chopped off. And look at the face, the wide eyes on him.
He does look scary. Here.
So, but in his, you know, buttoned up coat. So
very proper.
Yes. But that's a terrifying cleaver to come down at you.
And even though we don't get that grotesque description, right? We don't get the blood and guts and gore. We get like the double reveal of, you think he's gotten away, and then all of a sudden he drops into the bushes. He's trying to get out of danger. And then suddenly a deadly dizziness and sickness came over me. I glanced down at my hand, which was throbbing painfully. And then for the first time saw that my thumb had been cut off and that the blood was pouring from my wound. Endeavored to tie the handkerchief round it, but there came a sudden buzzing in his ears, and the next moment I fell in a dead faint in the rose bushes.
For the first time in my life, I fainted. First and only time
in my life.
We'll get to that in a later story.
That will come later.
But the so he faints. He discovers I have no thumb.
And, this is bad.
Yes, and passes out. Obviously, the loss of blood, and he's been running.
In the shock, it's pretty terrible. That second reveal is, you know, you think he's gotten away, You yes. think you've made a clean escape and you're worried about him dropping the 30 yes. feet from the window.
Well, we know it though. Like,
well, yeah, we know it.
The reader knows that he's lost his thumb. And so this yeah. is likely the time yeah. that happened.
Right.
But the reveal, it's like a reveal for Hatherley. Like,
yes.
Doyle's writing the story so that we get his own impression of what happened. Like, he didn't even notice it got cut off at the time.
Right.
Which makes sense. And, you know, high adrenaline in a pursuit, you're running away, and, you know, you may not notice if you lost a digit. So
this happens.
Yes. People get wounded in battle and they don't mm-hmm. know they're wounded when it happens. And then they realize that they were wounded.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he wakes up in the morning and he's near the station and realizes, oh my gosh, they must have brought me here, you know, because I was so far away from the station. Mm-hmm. How could I get here? And, he inquires about Stark at the station and nobody's heard of him. So then he's like, I think I'll just go back to town before going to the police here, because yeah. you don't want to go trust the police out in some out of the way town.
No.
Back to London. So gets on the train after he's lost his thumb.
Yep.
Bled out.
Yeah.
Passed out. Woke up
in the bushes.
He's like, I say, sir, may I have a ticket, please, for London, for Paddington Station?
Yeah, after he's made inquiries about this guy, yes. just casually. Yeah, and then it's like, could you give me a recommendation for a physician?
And that's his story.
Yeah.
Holmes says, and then Holmes, they sit in silence for a little bit, and Holmes right away pulls out from the shelf one of the ponderous commonplace books in which he placed his cuttings. So Holmes creates himself this kind of, you know, criminological, you know, encyclopedia that he's compiling, scrapbook that he's compiling yeah. himself. And he pulls out an advertisement that said, lost on the ninth instant, Mr. Jeremiah Hayling, age 26, a hydraulic engineer, left his lodgings at 10 o'clock at night and has not been heard of since. And it was a year ago. He says it was mm-hmm. a year ago. So, it has been an entire, so when he originally sees this in the paper, he thinks, that's an interesting
weird.
Piece. I'll save that. Maybe that'll come in handy one day. So we get a kind of look at how Holmes, thinks of things like the story begins. Well, when they first get to Holmes in the story, he's lying there reading the agony column. The agony column is this, you know, like people are missing, you know, and sometimes in people are giving coded messages to each other. We've had this mm-hmm. in other stories where we've talked about this. And the agony column is where this advertisement would have been. And this is what he does. He's constantly pulling out tidbits in the agony column. You think, maybe this will come up. A hydraulic engineer disappeared. That's an unusual, you know, occupation for someone then to be mentioned. So maybe that'll come up. And of course, somebody comes in who was a hydraulic engineer who was almost killed. Holmes, you know, has got the answer already.
Like, I have something for this. In the world's most morbid scrapbook, put together his own. Yeah, I imagine it's one of these things that is, you know, he loves because it's bizarre. And it goes unsolved. Presumably this guy is never found, and no one is the wiser for what happens, except that now we know.
Or is he? There's a theory about this story that a Sherlockian has written about long ago that Hatherley is actually Jeremiah Hayling, and he was involved with them for a long time and now has gotten out, and he's using this story to Watson and then Holmes to kind of get his life back after he has been with these criminals for a year. It's a fascinating way to look at a story. It's the way people play games like to do.
Mm-hmm.
The Holmes says they have to go up to Iford, and they get Inspector Bradstreet to join them. He was at the end of Man with the Twisted Lip. He was in the Blue Carbuncle, which we skipped, but we're going to do it right before Christmas. So actually, this is the third time the readers would have encountered Inspector Bradstreet. He's in three of four consecutive stories. He brings Bradstreet. Like, you know, we're used to Lestrade and
yeah. Gregson
is turned up. But it's early on, Holmes seems to he's adding Brad, but then he's gone. That's it. He's in these three stories, and then Holmes doesn't wind up using him. And he's quite friendly with Holmes and Man with the Twisted Lip. They seem to get along well, and Holmes likes him, and he's not like the jealous one like Lestrade is or Athelney Jones was.
Oh, yeah. Gregson.
He's someone it seems to have a good relationship with, a policeman.
It is fun to see Doyle playing with these secondary characters to try on the dynamic that he sort of likes.
Yeah. Well, they want to figure out where the house is because he drove for so long to it. So they do a map with a circle, a radius of 10 miles in the village. And it was like, well, I think he must have been north, south. And Holmes is like, it's right there. So
I love that they take bets, right? The plainclothes guy, the Bradford, Watson, everybody picks their own direction, and Holmes is like, well, you're all wrong. And they're like, that's not what one of us has to be right. We can't all be wrong. Oh, yes, you can.
And this goes back to the questions he asked Hatherley about a story, the details, the trifle that, you know, the horse was fresh. So it wouldn't have been riding, you know, 6 miles if it was, you know, it wouldn't have looked fresh. So at least he didn't say the color. It was a chestnut horse. No chestnut horse would travel 6 miles out and back. No, but it's because it's fresh and glossy.
Right, of course.
Holmes is, and it's one of those things that Holmes figured out. Holmes knew right away. Holmes knew it before they had to do anything. He didn't even have to smoke a pipe to figure it out. So usually
it's why he asks the question, right? It's like when Watson's like, how did you know to look for this thing? He's like, because I expected it, right? He asks the questions that he thinks he suspects he already has the answer to. He already has a working theory.
And he knows what they're doing already. They're counterfeiters. That's what they're doing. And then Bradstreet confirms that. He says, you know, they've been turning out half crowns by the thousand. We've even traced them as far as Reading, which is close to here. So the police have already been after these people. And but the inspector was mistaken that they haven't gotten them right enough. He says that the inspector was mistaken. Those criminals were not destined to fall into the hands of justice. And this is where this story really gets strange.
Takes a weird turn.
They see the house is burning. They find out that they confirm the description of Stark and Ferguson and who they were. The oil lamp must have started the fire in the press, but they're gone. And they found out that they had loaded up. The house is right there. Holmes knows the house is close to the station, and they just drove around, you know, in circles to make it seem like it was far away. Holmes's fears came to be realized, for from that day to this, no word has been ever heard either of the beautiful woman, the sinister German, and the morose English. That's a story. Like, that sounds like an unpublished case. The story of the beautiful woman, the sinister German, and the morose Englishman. And even Holmes's ingenuity failed to discover the least clue to their whereabouts.
They disappear without a trace.
They loaded up. They were seen on a peasant had met a car containing several people, some very bulky boxes, driving rapidly in the direction of Reading, where all traces of the fugitive disappeared. Like, they're gone. Like, they're just gone. Like, there's no investigation. There's no tracking them down. The machinery was destroyed.
Yeah, you'd think they'd be easy to find. They're quite a company with their strange boxes.
Yep.
And they just disappear. I mean, this is worse than the last time I was on, and the entire Gloria Scott was lost. Or not the Gloria Scott, I'm sorry, the Lone Star was lost.
Yeah. They found, but at least they died. Like,
yeah, at least, like, well, we presume, right? We presume they died. At least they find a part of the ship that they're like, okay, the boat probably sank. I mean, the boat sank and that was probably them and they probably died. With this, we just get no explanation at all.
The machinery's gone. They found nickel and tin in the outhouse, but no coins. But the firemen did discover a newly severed human thumb upon a windowsill of the second floor. So, hey, here you go.
Oh,
you go, Victor, you can at least get your thumb back. You know, put it in a jar and save it. The what they realize is he had to have been carried at least towards the station. And they at least find foot. Like, this is the only investigation that happens. Now, look, there's footprints, larger ones and smaller ones. So at least probably Ferguson, the other guy, and the woman carried him to the station, and that's it. And Hatherley says, well, it's been a pretty business for me. I've lost my thumb and I've lost a 50 guinea fee. And what have I gained? And
Holmes, in his infinite sensitivity, experience. And he laughs at it.
Yeah, thanks. Like, I had my thumb cut off. I've got nothing. All the bad guys got away. I mean, it's not like it's a weird resolution. There's no resolution.
There's no resolution.
No. This is,
doesn't seem like this is a major counterfeiting operation that's clearly been going on for some time and is causing pretty significant disruption. And they just get away and there's no consequence. And
now Watson did warn us that there were it's an unusual story. You don't get his usual deductive reasoning and all, but it's doubly strange. And then it's like, it's just a story somebody tells and then they go at the end and the criminals are gone. But you don't expect that they're going to just get away. I mean, and they're not just counterfeiters. They murdered someone else.
Yeah, horribly.
So,
they're foreign agents too. Like, this is infiltration. Like, it's like doubly disturbing because it's not just like a threat to the economic system of London with the counterfeiting. It's also like, it's a foreign threat. Like, these are foreigners coming in and getting away with this stuff.
It fits because it's a very uneasy story. Like, all this creepy, uneasy stuff happens, and Doyle is saying, I'm going to give you that ending too, that you don't, you know, there's no, and for all the, you know, and Holmes and Doyle are Doyle's home stories are very much about that kind of, you know, bringing order back, stopping the chaos. Sometimes Holmes is his own justice. Yes. Sometimes things just happen, like Providence, like at the end of the Five Orange Pips. But sometimes, maybe this is the only time, I can't remember, but, you know, talk about other stories.
Right.
For this story and this early on, you know, what happens is that sometimes the bad guys get away and you just are left with a weird story to tell.
And nine fingers.
Nine fingers.
It's terrible. Holmes is like, well, you'll be interesting at parties. You'll be a great conversationalist.
I give this story one thumb up because I can't give it to because one's gone. So, I really enjoy that about this. I think it's, you know, very interesting that is the way that it has ceased. That is the way that is that Doyle's chosen not to resolve at the end.
Because that is life. Sometimes you don't get the answers.
So
this German woman too, we get nothing about her. Like, she is the real MVP of this story. She does everything in her power to get this guy out alive and like really sticks her neck out for this guy. It can't be good for her. Whatever is going on in this operation that she's seemingly like being dragged into. And she's just like, I don't know. She's a fabulously interesting figure and we just don't get anything.
I'll have to look it up. I'm sure somebody has written some kind of story about Stark and this woman and, you know, the the German counterfeiters, you know, must exist in some other story in some way.
I hope she gets justice somewhere. Yes, she deserves good things.
Yeah.
I want a romance where she comes back and like they get married. Like it's
there
great.
You go. So would you take me? I'm a deformed man. She's like, of course I will. So
I've saved you once before. You know, it's all very Jane Eyre.
Well, Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 12 of Sherlock Mondays. Mary, thank you for staying up late and joining us all the way from Poland. That's a first. I don't think I've had a co-host in Poland yet. So you will return for episode 16 for the Copper Beach, the Adventure of the Copper Beaches. Yes. So you had to do that one, clearly.
I do. Tons of shenanigans, tons of self-promotion for our little home, Philly Scion Society.
Yes. That will be awesome. So coming up next week, everyone, Curtis Armstrong will return to talk about The Adventure of the Noble Bachelor, in which Holmes discovers just what nobility means to a nobleman. So that will be an interesting story to do. Thanks to our chat, Mrs. Hudson, today. Steve, Brianna had the night off. Steve, thanks for filling in and being our chat, Mrs. Hudson, and managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of Lisa Washington and all of our patrons who donate money to the Rosenbeck. You can support the Rosenbeck through donation or membership, and your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You could also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. Find out more at our website, rosenbeck.org. Again, let me remind you to subscribe to this channel. Like this video if you haven't already liked it. All the people watching it should have liked it or not like it. I guess you could not like it, but don't be negative. If you're listening to the podcast, leave us a review. Thanks, Mary. Thank you for my drink, too. I love
it. Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Everyone, I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Bye-bye.
The Rosenbeck Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays, sponsored by Lisa Washington, hosted by Edward G. Pettit. Music by Pleated Gazelle.